Today, a conversation with Steve King. Hello, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Today, I have Steve King with me via Skype. Hello, Steve. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
Thank you very much for taking time to speak with us. And I guess a good place to start is just, where are you now?
Yeah, okay. Well, professionally, I'm now one quarter time at Kingston, which is where I moved back in 2014 to be head of school and try to set up a non-orthodox economics department there. That was kiboshed by a government policy change, which is effectively the same change as which kiboshed the program at the University of Western Sydney when I was there. So following neoliberal ideas, the governments in both countries decided to deregulate student numbers for first year rather than saying a fixed number for history and art, et cetera, at different universities, open slather. That meant that students, because it's now a bums on seat payment system for universities in both countries, they mass migrated holus bolus to the more highly ranked universities. That's what wiped out UWS's program in 2012, which is why they made myself and four other professors out of five in economics redundant, along with 30% of the humanities staff there. Same thing has slowly happened over at Kingston. So I've gone from 22,000 students to 14,000 in the entire university. And so they had to downsize. That hasn't finished the program at Kingston, but it's compromised it significantly. I'm now one quarter time, and I'm continuing to do exactly the same thing as beforehand, trying to build a new economics and lobbying for reform of university education and economic policy in general. But I'm being funded by crowdfunding these days with the website Patreon. So that's my main form of finance. And without that, I'd be back in Sydney.
So good old,
fund me
good old.
And I won't come home.
Yeah, that's right. Pay them enough. Keep them away. I do Patreon too on DFA. It's actually quite good. So a really interesting place to start the conversation would be around debt, and specifically that paper that came out from the Bank of England a few years ago, which really put the cat among the pigeons in terms of thinking about the way that debt actually worked.
Yeah, I knew all the authors of that Bank of England paper before it came out, but I had no warning it was coming out. I was internally grateful to the Bank of England staff for this, because since the financial crisis, they have, I'm quite happy to admit it, they said, yes, we got the crisis wrong. We didn't see it coming. We thought we understood how the economy operated. We were smashed in the face by the economy in 2008. And unlike the Federal Reserve, which has really retreated back into the same way of thinking, the Bank of England has said we have to understand not just the textbook version of how the economy operates, but how it actually does. And they've gone well outside the textbook and found the work of people like myself, but also very significant predecessors like Basil Moore and Hyman Minsky and Wynne Godley and so on, and said banks create money when they lend. They do not lend out of a pot of money which is provided by depositors, which is the conventional model. They lend by putting an entry on the asset side saying, you owe us $1 million. And why do they get away with it? Because they say at the same time, here's $1 million in your deposit account. So the creation of debt is simultaneously the creation of deposits. And the causal process is the opposite to the mainstream theory. And now you now have not only the Bank of England coming out and saying that, but the Bundesbank. So the people actually in the front line of managing money are now saying the heretics like myself were correct, the mainstream was wrong. And that's a major change now, because you then have to say, well, if banks create money, what's the macroeconomic impact of them doing so? And that's what, of course, I've been working on for the last 30 or so years.
And so that means that there's no theoretical limit to the amount of money that they can create, right? Providing there are people who are willing to take the loans.
Yeah.
And the more that loans are taken, the more the assets are lifted up in value, or the more the deposits will rise. So it really turns the whole thing on its head.
It does. But what it means is people think the conventional thinking tells you the amount of reserves the banks hold are the limitation on their lending. And the limitation is those reserves multiplied by what they call the required reserve ratio. Now, of course, in many countries, including Australia, that ratio is zero. So it doesn't actually work as a control anyway. But in fact, that's wrong. If you think about a bank, you really have to think about a bank as a double entry bookkeeping machine. That's what banks fundamentally are. They have assets, they have liabilities, and the gap between the two is the equity. And a bank starts by getting money together, which gives it positive equity with no assets and no liabilities. And then it starts operating by creating loans and creating deposits at the same time. And without the capacity to take deposits, you can't create the loans, which is why it's just banks rather than building societies that can do this. But what it means is the limit is not the number of reserves, which are a particular type of asset you hold. It's the ratio between your equity, which is the gap between your assets and liabilities, the ratio of that equity to your loans that tells you how far you can go. And of course, if you start with a small round figure, say of a $100 million, if you're willing to have a 10-to-1 ratio of your loans to your equity, then you can lend out $1 billion. But if you're willing to go as far as let's think of a random invented company like, for example, Lehman Brothers. If you're willing to go to, say, a 30-to-1 ratio, then you can have $100 million worth of equity and $3 billion worth of loans and other assets. And then, of course, if those other assets fall by a mere 3%, your equity is wiped out. So it's the willingness to expand your ratio of assets to equity that gives you the capacity to create money. And there's no control on that. The banks can pretty much set what they like on it. And the really dangerous thing, which is what I've been working on in recent years as well, is the positive feedback between the value of the assets and the level of leverage they create. So what you have is you can have a runaway process leading to a huge amount of debt. And then as soon as that debt stops rising, the whole thing comes crashing down.
And in Australia, it's about a 5% capital to assets, right? So it's average.
Which means a 20-to-1 ratio. So all it takes is a 5% fall in the value of assets, and your bank is cactus, or your banking sector is cactus. And people talk about assets and liabilities as if they're equivalent. And in a mathematical sense, there is this rule: assets minus liabilities equals equity. So they're related that way. But your liabilities are your liabilities. If you owe money to a bank, you owe money to a bank. It's $1 million, you owe $1 million. But if a bank has assets of $1 million, that can be $800,000 the next day if the market prices collapse. If you're talking about assets, including shares and values of bonds and CDOs and stuff like that. So the liabilities are much more stable than the assets. The assets drag the liabilities up in that sense. When the assets come down, then you can go from having positive equity to negative equity overnight. And a bank with negative equity, by definition, bankrupt. And that's what happened back in 2008. Australian banks managed to avoid it, but by a rather dubious method.
Yes, something about borrowing from the Fed, I think, was involved, wasn't it?
They did a large amount of borrowing from the Fed, though, strangely enough, they are not, in fact, American institutions, but they did a large amount of borrowing that way. And, of course, they also just continued to lever up the asset market, really at the behest of the Rudd government. Let's not let the politicians get away with it here. Rudd, with what I call the first-time vendor's boost, restarted the housing bubble that was bursting back in 2008, and that kept the whole positive feedback process rolling on until about, 6 months ago or a year ago?
Yeah, well, it started to slide about a year ago, but the rate of descent is accelerating. Yeah. And most of the mainstream are still saying, "Oh, it's a minor correction; it'll bounce back again." But the fundamental thing that's changed now is that credit is much less available because effectively the Royal Commission and the regulators are finally bearing down on the banks, which means that suddenly the requirements are much tighter than they were. So this is a fundamental change.
Yeah.
But here's two questions then. The first is, if in fact it is the way that we have described it, then the whole BIS ratios, risk management, capital structure, doesn't actually regulate the banking system, does it?
No, it doesn't. This is the trouble, because the conventional economic theory, and anything believed by conventional economics is almost by definition wrong. The number of myths and nonsense that's involved in that area is just breathtaking if you take a good look at it, which I've done. But in the case of the rules, they effectively assume that the leverage that you take out does not affect the asset values. Now, I've done quite a bit of work on this front, as well as the theoretical and some empirical work as well, and the level of leverage you're willing to have does directly affect the value of the assets. So all their rules assume they're independent. and therefore you can trust the value of the assets as they stand. If they're not, then when you start to reduce your leverage, your asset prices can plunge. That's what, of course, happened back in 2008. It's what's going to happen to Australia in 2018.
Right. 2018. So this year.
It's already happening. I mean, it's a question of how fast. It's a snowball effect. But, of course, the catch, we'll talk about it. I'll let you ask the next question, but there's lots and lots of catches.
So that means that when APRA says the banks are unquestionably strong, the capital ratios are larger than ever before, they're sort of missing the point, aren't they?
They're missing the point because it's the level of leverage that's the danger point, and they see no particular danger in it. And this is a common theme in Australian regulators. They're no worse than the rest of the world. It's just that they're no better. Actually, I think they're slightly worse, frankly. They're more captured and they're more brainwashed. So like my favorite brainwashed individual in the Australian banking sector was actually Rick Battaglino, if you ever remember him. He's gone now. I think he's retired. But I'll have to find a quote from Battaglino. But looking at data which shows a screaming increase in the level of indebtedness of the Australian economy and Australian households in particular, he talked about it showing the democratisation of finance. I'll have to show you that quote later. I'll pass it your way. But looking at a level where debt is increased by a factor of 7, he sees that as democracy. I'm sorry, when you're in debt to a bank or anybody else, it isn't a particularly democratically enhancing experience. It's enslaving, not democratic. And they've ignored all this stuff, even though they collect the data.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the data they collect is not complete in the first place for all sorts of reasons, which means that they're actually flying blind to start with, but then effectively, philosophically, they're on the wrong path too. So the combination of those two things are pretty concerning.
And this is the effect of being educated, so-called, in mainstream economics, because it actually teaches you that banks, debt and money don't matter to the macroeconomy. And as absurd, most people believe that banks are experts on money, and that is... that's the conventional understanding. If you're an economist, you're an expert on money. In fact, mainstream economics teaches its devotees that you can ignore the level of private debt, you can ignore money, and still model the macroeconomy accurately. Now, that means that they can record data like I'm just about to show you now. This is from a speech from Battaglino.
Yep.
This is a graph. Okay, now you can see this is the long-term data series. I'm actually working on this right now because there's a bit of work in making it consistent with the BIS statistics, which I'm using these days. But that's the level of private debt from 1860 to 2007. Now you can see, anybody can't tell that that's an exponential increase in the ratio of private debt to GDP, then I suggest you get glasses or go learn a bit of mathematics. So there's been an exponential increase in the data from 65 to 2007 when Battaglino gave this speech. And his reaction to that was to say it was show. I'll actually find the word here, because I think it's incredible. He says, has this expansion run its course? Will it reverse? And we cannot know the answer, but my guess is the democratization of finance, which has underpinned this rise in household debt. So they record the data and see it as democracy, not as enslavement. And that's his household credit. This is just incredible, they're looking at the data and they're not seeing it because according to their theories, it doesn't matter. And these are the people who are supposed to be regulating the economy. I can't blame them individually. It's the education that they've suffered under that convinces themselves they can ignore these things and still model the macroeconomy. And of course, that's why they got it so badly wrong in 2008.
So the implications, though, of this is actually pretty worrying, isn't it? Insofar that means that the approach of monetary policy, where effectively you're trying to control the momentum in the economy from interest rates, is disconnected, right? Because it's disconnected from the process we've just been talking about. So monetary policy doesn't really work. And then the second is that the people in charge, so the Treasury, the regulators, they're all on this same myopic view of the way the economy works, which is actually different from the way it really works.
That's right. And this is the real danger. There's just this total disconnect between the real world and economic theory, at the same time as economists believing that they understand the real world. So you have a real tragedy that it's like you've got people on the deck of the Titanic who believe that icebergs are nice fluffy things that enable you to have a shower as you pass through them. So people think they're actually helping us avoid crisis. And I'll give you an idea of just how bad this is. I'm giving a talk at the OECD in a couple of weeks' time. This is one of the slides from the OECD. So I'll go back to grabbing the screen once more and just show you a graph. This is from the this is a paper by an economist called Ohanian. And he's often a co-author with Prescott. Prescott was the guy who got the Nobel Prize, I think in 2007, for the invention of the predecessor to what they call dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models, which they call real business cycle models. And looking at this data, he said there's nothing to worry. You can't say that there's any role of private credit in causing the financial crisis because, look, it's just as high in 2010 as it was in 2008. So obviously nothing going on there. What he's looking at, and I still find this breathtaking, what he's looking at is the level of private debt to GDP, not credit. Right. It's called credit in the database, but if you look at the definition, it's the outstanding level of debt. Credit is the change in debt. So he looks at that and says there's no problem because the level of private debt is much the same as it was before the crisis. And my little send-up to this is that it's a bit like saying to a judge, I'm sorry, I was only 30 miles from Sydney, therefore I wasn't speeding. And the judge says, you were doing 120 miles an hour, you were speeding. It's just simply not understanding because they're not even trained to think that way. So what I do in the next chart, this is a presentation I'm giving the OECD, the next week I take that same data and I look at its rate of change. And there's the rate of change. It went from, in this particular way of measuring it, it's different to the way that I record it, but we'll talk about that later if you like. It went from plus 7.5 to minus 9% of GDP in 2 years. That's what caused the financial crisis. The data that I'm looking at there is embedded in this data, which he's looking at back here, but he doesn't understand it, doesn't even see that it's happening. So that consequently, they don't even see this relationship, which I'm showing now, between change in debt, which is credit, and the unemployment rate. And therefore, you might as well have somebody who's had both their eyes poked out on the deck of the Titanic watching out for icebergs.
Right, okay. And of course, the thing about debt and the growth of debt, it isn't just in Australia and it isn't just private sector debt, right? We're seeing, you know, everywhere you look, you can see debt higher than it's ever been. So this is a structural issue for pretty much every Western economy around the world, isn't it?
It's a global phenomenon, certainly for the OECD countries. It hasn't got quite so bad in the emerging markets right now. Of course, they had their crisis back in 1997. Some of them are reapproaching it. So yes, the level of debt, both private and public, is higher than it's been in probably recorded history. There is a difference between the two, and this is, I mean, I'm not completely in what's called the modern monetary theory camp, but I'm certainly understand the accounting side, and I agree with them on that particular front. Government debt is simply like a bookkeeping entry, just like private debt is. Everything comes down to bookkeeping ultimately. So what we call the level of debt is a bookkeeping entry. On the asset side for the private banks, when you're talking about private debt, on the liability side for the government, when you're talking in terms of government debt, because that effectively shows, you know, they owe this money fundamentally. But the government has its own bank. And the government with its own bank can pay its own bills with its own bank. It's made very circumlocuous given the rules on central banks buying government debt and so on, but fundamentally there's no limitation for the I'll actually go back to stop sharing my screen while I talk about this. There's fundamentally no limit on the government's capacity to create its own money, and we saw that quite effectively. You know, people hear that and say, what are you talking about? Well, in America, every year since 2009, I think it is, the Federal Reserve has purchased $1 trillion worth of private and government bonds off the private financial sector. Where did they get the money? They made it up. They simply say, we want to buy those bonds. Here's $1 trillion in your bank accounts. Now please transfer $1 trillion worth of bonds to the actuary asset side, which of course the private financial institutions very happily do. So the creation of money is an accounting operation. And when you are the fiat currency issuer in your own country, there's no effective limit on how much you can do. And that's what they've done. So the government debt effectively is a record of accumulated money creation by the government. Now it can have effects that are deleterious to the economy. No argument there, okay? But there's no practical limit on the capacity to do it. Whereas in the private banking sector, when you borrow money from the banks as a private individual, you have to repay with money the banks create, not with money you can create. If you could create if your back room there had a little printing press that printed out money, then you'd be having a knock on the door in a moment. So a government is not like a household, because a household does not have a printing press. And that fundamentally is why the governments can keep on doing it. However, the level of government debt really moves in the opposite direction to private debt fundamentally. When the private sector is going in a debt finance bubble like Australia's been doing pretty much since 1993, and if we can go back even further than the data than that, but certainly it began under Keating and Howard inherited it, a real private debt bubble, that can enable the government sector to pay down its debt, because the extra spending out of credit that the private sector is doing boosts government coffers. So government debt goes down, but then when the private sector stops that borrowing, government debt goes through the roof, because all of a sudden tax receipts fall and they've got to spend more on welfare. Even a Liberal government has to do that. So consequently, you get a blowout in the budget and the government debt level rises, and as the private debt often fall. But it's a long-winded answer, but fundamentally what we've been living in, because we believe that banks can be self-regulated and banks can be responsible, et cetera, you've given people the capacity to create money and to put a fee on that creation process, and unlimited license to create as much as they want. And they've fundamentally sold us into the highest level of private debt in the history of not only of capitalism, probably the history of humanity. And we're now carrying that burden around our ankles. And the government debt's gone up in correspondence with the fall in private debt when the crisis hit. We really should be able to fight. My argument is we have to simply write the debt off and go back to zero. Governments can do that quite easily with their own money. It's more complicated for the private sector, but my feeling is we're pretty much trying to manage the economy with a ball and chain around our ankles called a level of private debt.
Yeah, and I'll come back to that in a second, but just to sort of complete the story, right? So high home prices are an outworking of all the debt, because effectively as the debt is created and expands, everybody then can afford to spend more. It lifts the asset prices, home prices grow even higher, and it becomes a circular argument, of course, because effectively the more it goes up, the more it can go up until it stops.
It's a positive feedback process, and this is one thing I've been working on. I've been putting out a paper. I'm years behind in getting the paper written up, because I keep having to delay getting things done by the continuous demands I get for immediate work. But people often say, look, it's just supply and demand that sets house prices, and then they jump over to saying, well, supply is rigid, that's why prices rise. They don't look at the demand side at all. So what I've done instead is say, well, where does demand for house prices come for housing come from? Where does the demand for that physical object we call a house come from? Well, the monetary demand for houses is fundamentally the change in the level of mortgage debt. That's where the money comes from. 80%, 90% of the purchase price in most cases is going to be mortgage debt. So it's new mortgage debt that is the actual flow of monetary demand per year for houses. If you divide that by the price index, you get how many sort of standard houses can be purchased with that flow of money. So what you get is a relationship between the change in the level of new mortgages. You get a relationship between new mortgages and the price level. Okay, because new mortgages are what help you buy houses, so new mortgages to have price level. There's therefore a relationship between change in new mortgages and change in house prices, and it's an extremely tight relationship. In America's case, the correlation between the two is about 0.8. So a change in, you know, fundamentally it's causing, you know, 65-70% or more of the change in house prices is coming out of the change in mortgage, change in new mortgages. So what's actually been driving up house prices is change in the level of new mortgages. So accelerating mortgage debt is what causes house prices to rise. Now that's the real trap that people who are, you know, believers in house prices can rise forever argument aren't aware of. They're relying upon the level of mortgage debt not just rising but accelerating over time indefinitely. Now it can't do that. Nothing can accelerate indefinitely. And you get to the point which the West, America and UK and Ireland and Spain hit back in 2008, where that acceleration ends. Australia kept it going by Rudd's maneuver with the first home vendors boost, and then the RBA coming in and cutting rates when they thought they were fighting inflation and found there was no inflation, dragging so-called investors in. And then, of course, sheer and outright fraud by the banking sectors were now being exposed by the Royal Commission, because there's no way we could have hit the level of mortgage debt without fraudulent behaviour by the banking sector over the amount of money they pumped out, what they pretended people were living on, how they fictionalised people's income statements and so on. It's a pretty tardy mess, and that's why Australia's hit the world record for the level of private debt by a country running a trade deficit.
And, of course, the reverse is true, isn't it? As effectively credit or the growth of credit slows, it doesn't have to go into reverse, but just the slowing trajectory is sufficient to have the downward pressure then on home prices. And the further the debt drops, the more home prices will drop, which is why my hypothesis is that we haven't even seen the start of the end of the drop, right? It's going to drop a lot
further.
That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, it is a crazy simple relationship in some ways, that if it's the change in new mortgage debt that drives the change in house prices, when the change in the mortgage debt goes negative, then house prices go down. And the impact is dramatic. I mean, might be best if I sent you some charts on this front. But if you look at the relationship between change in new mortgages and change in house prices in America, it just falls off a cliff from 2005. And you go from house prices, you know, rising 15% per annum to falling 40% over that time period. But the thing is, they can then rise on the other side when the rate of slowdown slows down. And this is the crazy thing. So you're seeing rising prices right now, even though mortgage debt is fairly flat in America, because it's the slowdown slowed down, and so you've now got an upward input as well. Understanding acceleration is quite a difficult thing.
Yeah, well, it's all about momentum, isn't it? The degree of the momentum. But of course, what the implications of that is that, you know, because everybody says, "Oh, we haven't got enough property being built. It's migration, et cetera, et cetera." But my modelling suggests that those other factors are there, but they're nowhere near as significant as this whole debt conundrum thing. It is debt that fundamentally is driving it.
Yeah, the credit's the most important determinant. And even with all those other factors, when you look at the relationship between change in new mortgages and change in house prices in Australia, it's still quite strong. Not as strong as the American because of those other factors, and also the extent to which the government has interfered in the market, frankly, courtesy of first home vendors, grants and stuff like that, negative gearing, halving the rate of capital gains tax. All those factors make Australia more extreme than other countries. It doesn't make it different.
Mm. Okay. So then picking up the other point you made earlier on about, well, so what do we do, right? So effectively the conventional theory is, what if we let home prices not grow as quickly but sort of wander sideways for a few years, then effectively income growth will catch up and everything in the garden will be lovely again, right?
Yeah.
My own view is that's just cloud cuckoo land. That will never happen.
It is. The reason it's cloud cuckoo land is because, and this comes back to how you think about the role of credit and debt in macroeconomics. Conventional economics says income is expenditure, which is correct. What you spend becomes somebody else's income. So expenditure is identically equal to income. But they ignore the role of credit there by saying, well, when you borrow money, the person you borrow money from can spend less, you can spend more. When you repay, the person you've repaid can spend more, you can spend less. It's like a seesaw. That's their model. That's where banks don't create money by lending. And so they say, whatever happened at the individual level, when you aggregate, all those things cancel out and there's no effect at the macro level. And I've mathematically modeled that. And if it were true, they'd be right. That's banks being, it's like the intermediaries, lending, providing a saver's money to a borrower and then charging a fee for the service. That's what I call the Ashley Madison theory of banking, you know. That's their theory. If that was true, then you could ignore credit. But we actually live a bit more in the red light district version, okay? And there the banks actually provide the service of debt. And because they do it, when the banks create debt, they also create money, which nobody borrows for the sheer pleasure of being in debt. So you borrow to spend. So that extra spend, change in debt becomes part of aggregate demand. Now, equally, it goes the opposite direction, which doesn't happen in the red light district. If you start paying that debt down, then the money falls and demand falls as well. So people think, well, we can just, you know, there's no problem with the house prices because the people have got the money, can afford to service it. That's assuming that their capacity to service is independent of the change in private debt. I think it can go to zero and there'll be no problem. If it goes to zero, aggregate demand will fall by something at the order of 10 to 20%. And it falls that much, you have an economic crisis and people lose their jobs, and then you get that positive feedback operation going in the opposite direction, driving house prices and down and unemployment up.
So then we're in the situation where conventional monetary policy and conventional thinking won't solve the problem we've got, all right? So then the question is, we've got this massive amount of debt around our necks, then what do we do about it? And I think you've suggested that, well, maybe we should just forgive it.
Well, this is the trouble. We fundamentally let the banking sector get away with creating as much debt as they like, to the limits of our capacity to absorb it, where those limits have been artificially expanded by fraud, as we're now seeing with the Banking Royal Commission.
Yep.
And that happened in every country that's applied, in Ireland, in Spain, in the UK. Fraud has been a major part of where the level of debt people are carrying is well far, far beyond what they can cope with. And the reason for the fraud is not on the borrower's side, it's the banks. They've said, don't worry. Yes, you know, we're only leaving you $70 a month to live on, but that's okay. You can dip into the credit card for a while. Would you like an increase in your credit card limit? And while that happens, don't worry. In 5 years' time, bang, you can sell the place for twice as much, and you'll be join the middle class, and up you go. It's no problem. Trust us. We have lots of PhDs and, you know, financial experts. You're just the dumb little householder. You trust our calculations. Then it all goes crop when they say, you risk irresponsible people, you borrowed more than you can afford. It's your fault. Screw that. The banks did it. Okay? And that's at the moment. I hope that's not going to be contested by anybody, including bank executives right now, unless they'd like to go and make an interesting statement to Commissioner Hayne. So the banks have been responsible for doing it. We have to get rid of the crap they've created. And we can actually do that using the government's capacity to create money, because there's three ways you can create money in a capitalist economy. This, by the way, separates me from modern monetary theory, which I've found myself caught up in a bit of a fight there, so I might as well be frank about it all the way through. I said there are three ways you can create money. Banks can create money by lending more than they get back in repayments. And that's what we've been relying upon without knowing it for the last 40 years. Governments create money by spending more than they take back in taxation. And that's the point that I agree with in modern monetary theory. The governments have a capacity to do that. And with an expanding economy and an expanding amount of money, the government should be regularly running a deficit to provide that money, rather than do it by giving money to students and by employing bureaucrats to control academics. But, you know, there's positive and negative ways about the way they can create that money, but they should be doing it. They haven't been, so I've relied heavily on the private sector. The third, where I separate from modern monetary theory, so say you can create money by exporting more than you import. Now, of course, Australia has not been doing that, running a trade deficit. So we've been relying heavily just on that government money, on that private sector money creation. And that's what's got us in this trap. To get out of it, let's use the government money creation capacity, what I call a modern debt jubilee. And when I first suggested the idea of writing off the debt, people said, well, you then benefit the people who speculated and you penalize those who didn't, which is true. So I said, well, let's create the money equally across the board. Everybody gets X amount of money. If you're in debt, it goes into an offset account that reduces your effective debt burden. If you're not in debt, it goes into a cash account with which you can buy corporate shares. And the corporate shares you buy must be used to reduce corporate debt. So what you could do with this is effectively have no impact upon the level of aggregate demand in the economy, so the inflation worries aren't necessarily there, but you would reduce the level of effective private debt in both the household sector and the corporate sector, and you democratize share ownership as well. Of course, that doesn't matter as much to Australia right now because you haven't had QE down there, but you will. Okay, that's what the Reserve Bank will be dumb enough to do, and that will inflate the prices of those who currently own shares, which of course benefits the wealthy who own shares over those who don't. So my proposal is to say, let's benefit everybody and reduce inequality rather than increasing it, which is what QE has done in the rest of the world. So you could do it in effectively by an accounting operations, reduce that level of private debt and get rid of the ball and chain around the foot of OECD economies, because I think the chances of that happening are about the same as a snowflake surviving in hell.
And suspect that part of that is because the bankers would resist it.
Yeah, but at the moment it's actually a good time to put it forward, because in Australia, bankers resisting stuff has become rather more difficult in the last 3 months. And there, even though I've known that some of the Bank West people who've been screwed by Bank West are complaining about the Royal Commission not doing a good job on their front, I think the Royal Commission's done an incredible job of exposing just how irresponsible the banks have been, how fraudulent, frankly, and of course, talking about criminal activities. This is the time when the banks are on the back foot. It's the time we should actually take advantage of that before they reassert their power, as they managed to do so effectively in America and the UK in 2008, 2009.
And one other question I had, because I've been looking at the Chicago plan, which is a sort of another way of thinking about how to deal with the problem, which essentially is going in the same direction, I think, but it's basically suggesting that what we want is we want banks who focus on lending to productive commercial outcomes rather than actually to stoke asset bubbles. Right. And effectively, similar approach in terms of effectively taking the debt out of the system, the household debt out of the system. So how different is your view to the Chicago plan?
The Chicago plan effectively said, let's make the textbook real, because the textbook model says banks don't create money, which is wrong. And what the Chicago plan is says, well, let's actually give them a bucket of money that they get given by the Federal Reserve, which they can lend out of, and they can make an arbitrage profit on the difference between what we charge them for the money and what they get if they lend the money out. I have two problems with that. One is that it's almost certain that the amount the Federal Reserve or the RBA or the Bank of England will create will be out of whack with the economy's needs at some point. The bankers will then launch in and say, it was all better when we controlled it, and give humans, frankly, 5 years, and they bloody well forget what they've been through. I'm speaking particularly with having been to Ireland last year and just being gobsmacked by a front page article on the main Irish newspaper with the governor of the Reserve Bank of Ireland there saying house prices are not a one-way bet. This is 5 years after they'd fallen 50% over a five-year period. Yeah. So we forget, and bankers will take advantage of that. So anything which says take the rights of money creation away from them entirely, I think they'll politically use as a way to come back and get it later when we all forget what happened. Secondly, I don't think that banks could actually survive on that arbitrage profit, because the idea that you can actually find the right people to lend to and make a profit and come out ahead, sorry, it's much more difficult than that. And banks really, if you think about banks as a business, they have a volume side and a price side. And what the Chicago plan would say, you've got to make money out of the price side alone. So you can't control the volume, but you make a price margin, make a profit on that. I think the banking sector would quite possibly collapse with that. They've got to have some of the volume business as well. So they've got to have the capacity to create money, but you have to make sure it goes towards productive uses rather than destructive ones. And you have to compensate for the fact that, generally speaking, it's very, very hard to work out which businesses are going to succeed if you're talking about entrepreneurs. So I still want to have some private money creation, but I want to limit it so they can't finance asset bubbles. Because the simple thing they've done you used to have people, and this is, I've got a couple of friend I'm thinking of here in the banking sector in Australia, who was a mining engineer, used to go around and assess mining projects, knew what he was talking about. He'd give money to the ones he thought were more likely to succeed. That's the sort of thing you want banks actually doing. That's difficult. It's much easier to say, yeah, prices are rising in that particular part of Sydney. Let's bank up the amount of money we give you, you know, and it's all bubble enhancing. Cut that out. I mean, you can just only make money by lending to the businesses for working capital or for investment. But then you have the problem that, you know, a lot of the time you're going to fail on that front, but you don't want your banking sector failing. So you have to make other modifications. That could include equity injections on a regular automatic basis by the government into the banks, so they, the money they lose in that sense is recreated, because you're seeing them creating the money for commerce to take place in the overall economy, that sort of thing. I even think that things like crowdfunding, giving people a certain amount of money to put into crowdfunding, is the one other way the government could enable the private sector to create that money in an entrepreneurial way, because to me the major difficulty is getting money into the hands of existing businesses and entrepreneurs. Banks are very happy to give money for asset speculation. They don't give it to businesses, generally speaking, anymore, and they don't give it to entrepreneurs virtually at all. So I'm more, and the other reason why I'm not a fan of the Chicago plan is that you do need to have a certain amount of the money being created on a speculative basis. And I don't want bureaucrats being in charge of speculation, because they're useless at it. I've had enough exposure to that myself in a university and in the wider world. So I want some mixture. I still want some private money creation, but I want it channeled. I want us to compensate for the inevitable failures of that money creation, so that in a much way that we don't have financial crises coming out of it.
Yes, thank you for that. So I guess my other question was, you know, a few years ago, quite a few years ago now, you were often quoted as saying home prices are going to fall, home prices are going to fall, right? Well, we now are beginning to see home prices are falling. So what's your thoughts in terms of the trajectory from here, in terms of what Australia is facing over the next couple of years?
Well, I mean, back to my little bet, which, of course, by the way, I didn't actually make the bet. I've learned in the future, if you make a deal with a banker, don't do it with a handshake, a written contract with the parties on the outside setting the terms. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done that walk to Kosciuszko before 2023, if at all. But anyway, back to that point, what I got wrong was the capacity of Australians to continue getting into mortgage debt. That kept on going up. What I got right was the causal process. Now, what you've done is we've now gone from where mortgage debt was something like about, I think about, what, 70% of GDP, to where it's about 100% now. So we've got a higher level of leverage than any country in the world has ever had before with the level of mortgage debt. And therefore, I think when the wind of growing mortgages is taking out of the economy tanks, and so do the house prices. And something of the order of a 20 to 40% fall is quite feasible. That's happened in every country in the world that's had a house price bubble. And we're finally realizing we had one too. And we had a large part of why I was there was fraud. So when you unwind fraud at a national level, you don't fall that far. Mind you, now that we have a property lobbyist as prime minister, then the government's going to dive right in and try to rescue the housing bubble. There's no doubt about that before him getting the job, but even more likely now that Morrison is prime minister, that they'll dive straight in and try to rescue the bubble first and foremost.
Yeah, my theory is, bearing in mind there's going to be an election next year, they will do a number of unnatural acts quite quickly to try and keep the bubble ahead. And then if they lose the election, it'll land in the lap of Labour, and then Labour will be accused of poor economic management. That's sort of how I think it's going to play out.
It's exactly how I feel as well. And this is like my last book, Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? I spent a fair bit of time discussing just that point, and in particular referring to Australia in that section as well. And when you look at it, I call it the political economy of debt. And one of the great dangers of this is that because rising debt is caused by large levels of credit, then when private debt is rising, credit's strong, aggregate demand is strong, and the government at the time can take the credit. Look what great managers of the economy we are. And then when the credit stops rising, the economy falls over. Look what pathetic managers you are. But in fact, it was set up by the rise in debt in the first place. So if you want to say who's responsible for the financial crisis in Australia in in 2018? The answer is it's a shared there's two people on the podium, John Howard and Paul Keating. They set it up. Okay. Yep. In England, it's only one person on the podium, Maggie Thatcher. If you look at level of private debt in UK, and this is one of the most striking charts in that little book of mine, private debt in the UK between 1880 and 1980 never exceeded 75% of GDP. 2 years after Maggie gets in control, it goes from 75 through her role and through Tony Blair's to pretty much 200%. It's now about 170% of GDP. So the bubble that collapsed for the UK in 2008, they blamed it on Gordon Brown. It was actually Maggie Thatcher and, in that sense, Tony Blair who deserved the blame. And the same thing will apply in Australia. So Bill Shorten will probably cop it. I'm just hoping the bubble starts falling over on Morrison's watch and therefore the Liberals cop the blame. But in fact, as I said, it's a shared thing. It's John Howard and Paul Keating. Hello, Paul. Sorry. You helped screw it up with the first-time voters grant, and by not having a, I mean, it's hard, no problem. I totally concede this one, but you should have blocked negative gearing. Okay. Mm. So those factors, they're what led it to qualify. It'll fall on Bill Shorten's head, and that's the great danger. The political scene will blame Bill Shorten. It's actually everything that was done back in the days of Howard and Keating that led to the situation we're in now.
And a final question on that, because my theory is if you go right back and you talked about Maggie Thatcher, right, it was about the financial deregulation, right?
Yeah, fundamentally. In fact, in the UK, the special thing, it wasn't just the Big Bang. The Big Bang was about, I think, 86 or so. It was 82, they deregulated the mortgage market and allowed banks to lend into what used to be the province of building societies alone. And it's 82 that the bubble began in the UK. So it's letting private money creation get involved in house prices. That's the danger. And the UK is a perfect example of the dynamics of that process.
Mm. Mm, okay. So so we've got people who watch this channel, and I've been trying to sort of raise awareness in Australia of the fundamentally importance of different thinking about this, right? Because effectively it's all about debt. And I've got a few people in them positions of power now beginning to understand that maybe there's an alternative narrative, but it comes up against the fundamental thing that we spoke about earlier on, which is that the standard way of thinking about the problem in government and in the Treasury and in the Reserve Bank and other regulators is still the old school. And I'm suggesting that that's the same in many other countries too. So are we then going to end up with another boom and a bust and a boom and a bust, because essentially on the old school, on the old way of thinking, that seems to be the only way out of the problem?
Yeah, I mean, again, because they ignore the role of credit, they don't even understand what's causing the ups and downs in the economy. I think I talked about Ohanian. Did I do that in this particular segment and show the Ohanian slides? I can't remember, but I'll pop them your way. They can look at the data and not even see it because they don't even understand money, even at the level of the money multiplier models. They don't even use that in their models. So they're completely blinded to what actually causes the crisis. Now, when you have a debt crisis like the one that hit America, there tends to be a fall in the level of private debt for a while because people are deleveraging, but that only went a very small way. So in America's case, you went from debt being 1.7 times GDP, private debt, to 1.5, and now it's growing from that level again. Now, what that means, if you compare it to the Great Depression, it went from about 100, in normalized numbers, about 130% at the peak of the Great Depression in 1932, down to 30% in 1945. So that's why we had the great long boom in the 50s and 60s, was because credit could be large because debt was small, and therefore the drag effect of more accumulated debt was more than compensated by the increasing credit demand, and you had a booming economy for 20 years. Now, when you're starting with a debt level of 1.5 times GDP and your peak was 1.7, there's not much headroom. So what you get out of this is what I call turning Japanese. You remember the old song. Once you've accumulated that level of debt and you don't wipe it out, then you can never have anything like the boom you had beforehand. Now, in Japan's case, Japan peaked at, it had a crisis beginning in 1990. It peaked at about 2.25 times GDP for its private debt level in about 1992-93. It's since fallen to 160%, but it's had 25 years of stagnant growth because credit demand's been effectively negative for most of that time. So what you have is a period of continuous stagnation rather than another boom on the other side. Any booms are short-lived. And coming back to your interest rate point, this is actually made worse by the central banks of the world, because leaving debt out of their equation, they see a rising level of inflation occurring when the economy starts to recover. They put the rates up thinking they're going to reduce the investment demand. They don't realize they probably encourage the private sector to go back into deleveraging again. That's what happened back in 1937 in America when Roosevelt was persuaded to cut the government deficit because unemployment had fallen from 25% to 11% by that time. He started trying to cut the deficit. The private sector started deleveraging again, having negative credit. Unemployment went from 11% to 20% once more. So I can see the Federal Reserve doing the same thing at Trump's expense. And the RBA, of course, will follow suit because they're just as textbook bound as the Federal Reserve, if not more so.
Okay, so final question, right? There are a lot of individuals who watch the Digital Finance Analytics blog. And I guess my question to you is, what is the one thing that you'd want them to take away from this conversation? You know, hang it out there. What is it? What's the point?
Well, the point is that credit is an essential part of how a capitalist economy functions. And if you have an economist who just says credit doesn't matter, ignore them. Okay, and you have to, if you're going to have a well-functioning capitalist economy, you need a controlled financial sector. So people who are talking about controlling the economy, from my point of view, what I'm saying is I'm not trying to control individual capitalists or individual entrepreneurs. I'm trying to keep the financial sector in a box where it is the servant, not the master. And if you let the financial sector become the master, as Australia's well and truly done, then you end up in hell ultimately, even though you might go through heaven. You look like you're going through heaven to get there.
Steve, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. I know that the people who follow me on the blog will find this a really fascinating conversation. So thank you very much. And I think we should compare notes again in a few months when we've actually seen the prices go even further down, because I think this is only the start of the slide. I think we've got a lot more to go from here.
Well, it's going to be fun watching how Morrison reacts. He can delay the election until May of next year, can't he?
Yes, that's right. May is the latest.
Clearly he will. So, it's going to be interesting to see the increasing level of panic because, of course, just on that little point, the crisis in Canberra had nothing to do with economic policy. It was all about Tony Abbott's need for revenge. So there's no way in which this is pushed by economic performance. But when the pony starts to fall over, then all hell's going to break loose inside the political arena. And I desperately hope it all happens on the Liberal Party's watch so that the electorate doesn't fall for the Murdoch case, which is going to be, it's all Labor's fault when the economy falls over.
Thank you, Steve. Well, I've got this vision of the Titanic that you painted for me earlier on, and at the moment it looks to me as though we're still heading at 90 miles an hour to that iceberg, and I suspect the iceberg will not be friendly.
No. Unfortunately, that's a little myth the neoclassical economists have, and every time they bump into it, it gives them a total shock and they go back to believing the same nonsense afterwards, but only after most of the passengers on the line have drowned.
Thank you, Steve. Good to talk to you. I really appreciate your time. Have a good day.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks. Well, I hope you found that as interesting a conversation as I did. Steve is certainly worth a good listen. And if you found this valuable, please do like the post and add a comment or question. I'll read them all. And if you'd like to support us as we create our content, please do consider joining our Patreon program. The link is in the comments below. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.